This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hello, once again. We welcome you to volume number 4 of the Pro Wrestling Love Podcast, looking at the top 25 TNA and Impact Wrestling matches of all time. I'm joined by Jerome, aka LP, on the Pro Wrestling Only forums. I am Marty Sleaze, aka Superstar Sleaze, on the Pro Wrestling Only forums. We're excited today to enter the top 10 of our top 25, covering 10 through 6. So I hope you enjoy this podcast.
So are you? Do we do your 11 then? Your 11.
Daniel's at the decision.
Yeah. All right, so we're done with the 11, so I'm doing my 10 then.
Oh, okay. We're getting into the top 10. It's going to get heated.
It's going to get heated now. All right. Yeah. So my top 10 is yet another AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels match. This is their Iron Man match from 2005.
Okay. So, of course, I have it.
Do you have it higher?
Okay. Yeah.
All right, so what's your number 10?
Oh, you're not going to like that. Oh, maybe you're going to like that. I'm not sure.
Let's see.
My number 10 is Kurt Angle. It's a cage match.
Okay.
And it's against Mr. Anderson.
Oh, okay. I actually do like this
Anderson.
Match. Anderson, yes.
See what I did there? Okay.
Yes.
From Lockdown 2010.
Yep. I do like this match. Go ahead. It didn't make my list, but I can definitely talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised because to me, Mr. Anderson was like your typical WWE reject at this point. I wasn't really a big fan of his work the first few weeks when I was rewatching TNA 2010, which was wonderful to watch the weekly TV. Just wonderful. But he's a guy who kind of enjoying his work because he's a very hard worker. Not a great worker by any stretch of the imagination, but he works very hard. And in this match, you have the Kurt Angle, which is straight babyface, like really straight babyface. And for those who, like you, I guess, I presume, who think Kurt Angle always works the same way and is only interested in doing spots, of course not. This is like the absolute great struggle, hate-filled match you can find in a cage with Kurt Angle playing babyface.
I agree. Yep.
With the famous saying like bringing the hate. Well, if this match doesn't bring the hate, I don't know what match bring the hate, because Kurt Angle really brought the hate in that match. Tons of blood. I mean, the poor Mr. Anderson is like, it's just bleeding buckets. And I love the way this match is structured. So, of course, you're going to have the usual Kurt Angle stuff. I mean it's going to hit suplex. But what's good about Kurt Angle as a babyface, it's because he's so badass. It's such a badass babyface because you know he's stronger than his opponent. He's more dangerous because of all the suplex and the ankle lock and stuff. So Mr. Anderson is going to play like the sneaky heel because he doesn't have a lot of great offense to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that's not his character. So basically you have Kurt Angle beating the hell out of Mr. Anderson. That's very old school, actually. Very, very old school. And a lot of interesting twists, because at some point you have Angle who puts the ankle lock on Anderson, which is interesting because it's a cage match. And I think it was an escape cage match, which is bad, but they made it work actually, because I don't enjoy the escape rules usually.
Right.
And so he basically screws up his ankle and is going to basically won the match. The guy cannot move anymore. He goes to walk out and you got Anderson who flips off Angle. So Angle goes back and then he gets screwed. I mean, I don't remember the exact spot, but Anderson catch him and then hit segment, okay?
Yep.
And then it goes reverse, and there was this spot when Kurt Angle actually gets the key to the lock. No, there is a lock. I'm getting confused. No, there was a lock. Okay, yes.
There's a lock. Yeah, I'm reading my room. There's a key and a lock.
He takes the key and he throws the key outside the cage. And there was this great facial by Anderson who's just terrified because Kurt Angle doesn't want because he can win the match, but he just wants to beat him more and more and more and more. And so the match builds and builds and builds of course, it's a cage match and it's Kurt Angle, so you got to have an insane spot somewhere. And the guy is obviously insane because he goes up to the cage and then you can say, yeah, but it doesn't make sense. But of course it makes sense because he wants to really punish Mr. Anderson. Plus, it's Kurt Angle, so he has to do something stupid and impressive. And he's a show-off. I mean, it's in his character, too. Whether babyface or heel, he is a show-off. And he does that incredible. Do you remember the moonsault he does from the top of the cage?
Yes, that's scary the one.
It's scary as hell because he doesn't really goes back. He goes really up. So you almost think that he's going to hit the ropes or something. Of course, he clears the rope and he hits the target. But it's scary.
Well, you know what's crazy in hell to me in that move is that Anderson took it. Usually, yes. Angle belly flops. Usually,
no,
when you see that move, the
course.
Dude's gone. Yeah,
it's like the whole Ric Flair never hits someone from the turn, which is not true, but he does actually sometimes. But usually, yes. But Anderson takes it. I mean, Anderson takes a beating in this match. It's incredible. The hit is great, and I love the finish. After the I think it comes after the moonsault because it's the perfect climax. I mean, it builds, and there is a sense of how do you say? Anyway, I'm not going to find the English word, but basically it builds, and as he's trying to walk, you have Anderson crawling, trying with bloody as hell. It's a great visual, man. Great. In a promising context, he's crawling to get out of the cage, and of course he can't. And you have Kurt Angle who just walk over his dead body, and as he's walking out, you remember what he does?
Does he steps on his balls, doesn't he?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a great facial, and he just walks on, which is a bitch. I mean, it's just a heel move. That's not nice. And it's just like it's just an awesome brawl. Hatefield, great work, great little twist, like, you know, like getting back in the ring and getting caught, or throwing the key outside, and then this final spot, like just he's squashing his balls as he's walking out of the cage.
That was a good spot.
He cuts such a great babyface promo after, because he was going away for a few months. When I'm coming back, I'm going to win the world title. It's just an awesome baby face. And for those who think that Kurt Angle just does the spot, you want to see a good old-school Hatefield, the bloody cage match, there you go. And you got your insane Kurt Angle spot that it's pretty much requisite. You got it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so I agree with you. Honestly, I think instead of a top 25, if we did like even like a top 26 or 27, this would have made it. This was like one of the last cuts for me. So I agree with everything you said about Kurt Angle. He was a strong, violent ass kicker. And
yeah.
You're totally right. Basically, he had that match won 3 times in a row, and he just kept coming back for more punishment. The key throw out to the crowd was awesome. That was like one of the best moments. That was pure perfect pro wrestling.
Yeah, and I haven't gave enough credit to Anderson because his play, what he does is really good. I mean, he takes a beating. It's awesome selling, like you said, the key throw. He looks like, oh my god, no! And he's such an asshole too. That was his gimmick, basically. But he really works very hard. Like you say, he takes the freaking moonsault of the cage, which is insane because there's no way you can protect yourself. I mean, especially the way Kurt Angle is hit, which looks totally out of control.
Right. I mean, yes. I think he landed. I mean, according to my notes and like my recollection is he pretty much landed right on Anderson's face. Like it was not clean moonsault. Like Anderson, like. Got hit, like it looked like it hurt type moonsault. Yeah, I guess my nitpick is I didn't think the beginning was all that great, probably. Like, once they did the whole, like, Angle comes back to beat him up more, that, like, was really, really good. But, like, I thought the beginning was kind of just like, this is fine, this is fine. And then it got really, really good. So I think that was kind of, like, why I didn't put it in the top 25 when I was comparing it against other matches. But, no, it was definitely an awesome match. And to your point, yes, this is Angle. This is, like, the second best Angle TNA match I've ever seen.
Well, it's one of the, yeah, clearly it's one of the best. One thing you said about the match at the beginning is, it's funny because to me, when I was doing the rewatching, something there, basically to me, there is two kind of great matches. There are the great matches who are great from the start and basically will remain on the same line. And it's great and it's great and it's great. Okay, it's great. And there are the other one, which in fact may be even better. It's much begins maybe good or okay, it's good. And then it gets better and then it gets better. And then, yes, actually really good. And then after 15 minutes, well, it's really an excellent match. And then it keeps getting better and better and better. Usually there's a switch sometime when it goes from, well, it's a really good match to, no, this is just a great match, usually. And actually, it's probably even more satisfying to watch because at the beginning you're like, yeah, it is good. And then it builds, and at the end, oh my God. So, I mean, and there are the match where, okay, this is great from the start. And
well, what's interesting is there's a third option, and the third option is like the most frustrating option, and I never know what to do with, is the match that's really good at the beginning, but then ends up sucking at the end.
Oh, like, yeah.
Like, there's so many Noah matches that are like that. Like, you're like, oh, man, this Kenta match is so good. And it's like, oh, fuck, this is like 15 minutes way too long. Like, and that's like the most frustrating thing in the world. When the beginning is so good and like the ending is just like, why is this taking forever?
Yes. When I used to talk about self-conscious epics.
Yeah,
that was a little bit of that. I think I coined the phrase with John Cena and CM Punk. I think I wasn't watching the product back then, but there was so much hype with Summer of Punk and everything that I watched that match back then, and I was like, "What is this?"
I kind of see your point. I mean, it's been a second since I've seen that match, but like it is a little overrated. The Money in the Bank one. I actually think the Raw 2013 one's really, really good, but the Money in the Bank one's a little overrated.
I have no idea what I would think about those match now because my taste have changed.
Our taste all changed, right?
5 last years, I have changed a lot. I mean, 5 years ago, you have told me that I would love Kenny Omega of the Young Bucks. I would not know they're like the shit, and now they're like my favorite wrestler ever.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. Like, I definitely have turned the corner on the Young Bucks. I think the Young Bucks are phenomenal. I still find Kenny Omega to be a little too Noah. You know what I mean? Just like that overkill. I know that you feel the difference. I mean, this is a TNA podcast,
but it's funny because there are four guys, and if I go to the PW board and I find my old posts, I would want to slap myself. Shut the fuck up.
We've all been there.
And it was the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, and Will Ospreay. The first time I saw those guys. And I was like, what? What is this? And now you're asking me, they're like the greatest. I love them.
Okay. So, I got to see a little bit more Ospreay. I've only seen a handful of matches.
But Ospreay has changed a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he evolved a lot.
But anyway. So that was your number 10, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so my number 9. All right, so after three Christopher Daniels and AJ Styles matches, we're changing it up, but it's going to be a fourth Christopher Daniels match. This time he's defending the X Division Championship against Samoa Joe on Impact. It's 2006, April 13th.
Okay, I don't have that one.
Don't have that one. Okay, so I love this match. I think we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about Christopher Daniels versus Samoa Joe. AJ Styles versus Samoa Joe is going to get some love later on. I think a lot of people like that. But I think the forgotten combination is the Daniels-Joe combination. And this is definitely their best match together. So this is opening Impact, and what's special about this Impact is Sting is actually main eventing. It's the first time Sting is wrestling on free TV, I think, since like WCW. So they're trying to pop a big rating, and so that's why Daniels is Daniels and Joe open the show. And what's interesting is they don't actually show the opening bell. It's joined in progress, and the very first thing you see is Joe busting Daniels wide open. He taps a gusher, and then while Daniels is selling, like writhing like a bloody fish, they show a video package that shows you all the highlights of the beginning of the match. And then they go back into the match, and Joe is just this awesome monster in it, super violent, bites the cut, punches the cut. And I mean, I think one of the things that we've talked a lot about in this podcast is all the is about selling, but always fighting back. And Daniels is doing a great job at this. Even though he's a bloody mess, he's so desperate. He's struggling to keep fighting, to keep moving forward. But this monster island, he's just beating him down. Tons of cutoffs. It's really very tense. A lot of drama. And eventually, Daniels starts catching Joe in the head with enziguris. Joe doesn't bump initially, which is great. He does the whole Crusher Blackwell Weeble Wobble sell, and that gradualism lets you earn it. And so that when Daniels finally knocks him off with a crossbody from the top rope, you know, the crowd pops, I pop, it's great. And they just do this big finish. It's a sprint, by the way. This match, I think, was like, I think total was 15, but like of shown, I think it was about 10 to 13. And it was just on fire the whole time. And so Daniels makes that comeback, and Joe comes back with a palm strike right to the cut and just totally cuts him off. And then they go into the finish. The finish, I totally thought Daniels was going to win this match. I bit on this near fall so hard. It was his typical STO best moonsault ever combination. I'm like, this is the bloody babyface. He's going to win. He's the defending champion. Like, he's going to break the undefeated streak. And because I hadn't seen this in – I don't know if I know I must have saw it in real time, but I hadn't seen it since 2006. So I was like, oh, he must have been the one, because I couldn't remember how. Oh, Joe's undefeated streak broke at the hands of Angle. I guess I shouldn't have been, but I did bite. And anyways, so he kicks out, and then it's the Island Driver from the top rope that finishes it. What an epic finish! So, and just another awesome sprint from Samoa Joe. Who's had three on my list against Austin Aries, Chris Sabin, and now Christopher Daniels. So just awesome job by the two of them.
Yeah, I kind of forgot, I think, this period of Samoa Joe. It was in 2000. He was at his best, I believe, back then.
Yeah, 2005, 2006 is prime time Samoa Joe for sure.
Yeah, because it was before he got ruined by the booking, and then it was never the same, I think, to me. I actually don't remember that much, because it was on Impact too.
Yeah, it was on Impact. I don't want to say I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's the only Impact match I have.
Yeah,
I think all my matches come from from pay-per-views. Otherwise,
I don't have any Impact match. But I could have, but yeah, no, I actually don't remember that match at all, because it's been a while since I've watched TNA. It was 2006, so yeah, it's been. But it was still. What date was that?
April 13th.
April, okay, because I remember that to me, 2005 and basically the first half of 2006 were really the best period from TNA from the first decade at least.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I'm not surprised that, because at that time it was the apex of the X Division with Chris Daniels and Samoa Joe and AJ Styles working together. So I'm not very surprised there. I kind of remember now that you mentioned the blood. Yeah.
The blood. I think the blood stands out, and the fact that it was joined in progress stands out.
Yes, that too. Yeah. Because I don't think they've done that very often.
Honestly, it's kind of an interesting thing. I'm surprised it wasn't Russo who thought of it, because it seems like one of Russo's good ideas. You know what I mean?
No, it was Scott D'Amore who was booking.
Because it's I wouldn't do it all the time, but like once a year seems like a good way to do it. But anyways. I thought I wanted to say something else about this, but I can't remember what it was. Yeah, to me, it's hands down the greatest match in Impact, the TV show, not if you don't like free TV
match
that TNA ever had. So
Yeah, Impact could be rough as far as, because there, once Russo came back, there really were. I mean, on paper, you still had some great match because there was so much talent in the company. Yeah. But on Impact, with Russo at the helm, yeah, it was pretty rough.
I guess some people really like that Beer Money Motor City Machines Gun match. I think that was on Impact. I think a lot of people have that as the greatest Impact match of all time, but I think this is a lot better. But that's the other one that I think people like.
Yeah.
So what was your number nine?
Oh my God, it's gonna be a tough sell. I know beforehand.
Okay.
So I'm gonna take a deep breathing before.
So it's an AJ Styles match, okay?
Yep.
Against Kurt Angle, the infamous last man standing match at Hard Justice in 2008.
This is the match I called a video game death match. I still remember.
Yeah.
Is this the match that you got pissed at my review about?
Not at all. No, I totally disagree. Yeah, to me, now, like I said, I'm not super fan of the Last Man Standing match, but likewise in the Chris Daniels match, they absolutely don't overdo the gimmick for once. So that was a good thing. I love Kurt Angle in that match because, like, he was a great baby face, a great badass baby face in the Mr. Anderson match. This may be his greatest, this or maybe then, yeah, another match, but maybe his greatest Dick Hill performance to me. Because, for instance, like, I don't remember the actual angle because the booking was so rotten that basically the angles were not very important to me. So the match mattered most. But so it was basically the start babyface. I don't remember exactly the context. Okay, so let's just put that out there. And the first thing he does for a guy who's supposed to be like just spot video games. Okay, first thing he does in the match, AJ Styles goes for a lockup, and Kurt Angle slowly goes outside and do the old Larry Zbysko spot. Yeah, I'm just gonna walk outside, which is awesome dick move. You agree?
Yes, I mean, stalling can be great, yes. I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've seen this.
Kurt Angle actually stalled. And he did that a few times until AJ Styles, of course, lost it. And there's another, because to me, I remember a few spots like that. And another one is Kurt Angle doing a belly-to-belly suplex. And the most impressive belly-to-belly suplex ever, because you have, of course, AJ was going to jump like crazy to make it look like the greatest thing ever. But Kurt Angle doesn't go down. You see, he stands still, okay? Which is incredibly impressive. And after the spot, he just go into the rope, and he's leaning on the ropes and just has this great snarky smile, which is, it's just an awesome heel spot to me. It's just great because it's like, well, just look at what I just did. Instead of going, no, it's actually killing the pace. He could go for, but plus, since it's a last man standing match, it actually made sense because he doesn't have to cover. Yes, he has to cover actually. Yes, you have to cover, and then it's. I really don't like the.
It was a death match. I think they might call it last man standing, but it followed death match rules.
Yeah.
Where you have to pin the person and then the count starts.
Yeah. But I mean, it's such a great spot because it's a huge spot. It's super impressive and just leaning on the rope and it's just smiling like, and to me, that's just great heel work. And basically, that was that. And plus, what I really enjoyed is that maybe that's what you didn't enjoy, but I don't know. But when you say last man standing, you kind of expect more of a brawling type match with blood and stuff like this. And instead, they decide, okay, we're going to do our usual kind of spot and usual kind of work style because we don't need to change our style to knock the other one down. And that's one thing I actually like a lot because I don't enjoy when someone has to totally change his style to work some kind I mean, it can work if you are really great, like AJ Styles or Chris Daniels doing a brawl. Okay, why not? And if you're really good at it, it's great. But if you're not really good at it, it can be awkward, I think. And to me, Kurt Angle doesn't have to do anything other than being Kurt Angle and being a badass, because that's what he is. So, of course, he's going to do tons of suplex. He's going to do ankle locks. And he's going to work his usual self, because it's enough to knock the other one down. So to me, it was kind of... So I understand the criticism of... Yeah, it's not worked like a brawl, but it doesn't have to, actually. You can work around the gimmick of the match without having to... Okay, it's this gimmick, so we have to work that kind of way. No, you don't. And I think they do a tremendous work with the actual gimmick when they go for the count at the end. And they both are great setups. I mean, AJ Styles is a tremendous seller, I mean. But actually, Kurt Angle is too, when he wants to be. And I think, yeah, it was, to me, it's the definitive Kurt Angle AJ Styles match.
That I probably agree with.
Great performance by Kurt Angle, which is such a dick. And of course, there is the post-match, which is ridiculous. And it's total Vince Russo bullshit, because basically, after a match where Kurt Angle is vicious heel and basically a total douchebag, you got and he loses the match, and yet you have AJ Styles losing it and just beating on Kurt Angle like total insult. So, but that's stupid booking.
Okay, that is dumb booking. Yeah.
But I love the match. I love how they work the count at the end, because there was one moment that you really think, oh, it's gonna be and they don't overdo it. They do a bunch of it, but really near the end. Which is nice, because what I don't enjoy in those kind of matches usually is when a spot that you wouldn't get the cover in a normal match, since you have to get the three counts to get to the counts. This spot that would not work otherwise. Oh, man, how's that? This match, this time it works, and then you do the counts. But it's kind of awkward and fake to me, and they really use the gimmick right to me. So. I really love that match. But you don't. I lost you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I was on mute. My bad. Yeah, so I didn't hate it per se. I actually think it was pretty good. To be honest with you, I haven't seen it since 2013, so it's been 7 years. I can't believe it's been seven years, but it's been a long time. Yes, I didn't rewatch it because my initial review said it was pretty okay, so I didn't think. But yeah, I guess the outside does look – or sorry, the beginning when they were outside looks pretty good. The overhead suplex into a guardrail sounds pretty good. I say that European uppercut by Angle's violent. So it sounded like they were off to a great start. They do the somersault off the ramp, which is fine. I think it was at
–
main issue was – well, first off, I can't stand Kurt Angle and his ankle lock reversals. But I don't know how many they do in this match, but they probably did at least a couple. But what's weird is like AJ like taps Angle to his own move, even though Angle like constantly has reverses. What was it?
It's Ric Flair.
Okay, so...
To me, it's funny
Flair
because...
never tapped to the figure four, but okay, yeah.
Yeah, but everybody... I mean, the reversal... At first, I didn't like the ankle lock because I thought it was bad. It was not a very exciting visual as a submission. But the more I watched the match, I mean, it only makes sense that... Everyone is reversing the hold, because at some point, if you watch a match, 1, 2, 3, 10, 1,000 match, you're going to learn how to revert the freaking hold. So,
all right, so this is my thing.
If no one ever reverts that hold, And then I think, basically, Ric Flair's entire career, he was putting the figure, he was supposedly the specialist of the figure four, the master and whatever. But
right.
Every jobber in the country had probably reversed the, I could reverse the figure four, I think, if I was Ric Flair in 85. So it's basically the same thing.
So this is my double. All right, so let's talk about Kurt Angle and the ankle lock. So to me, I've made this comment a lot in reviews, and it's probably true that if I end up going to hell, I'm pretty sure hell will be me watching Kurt Angle do crappy ankle lock transitions for the rest of my eternity. So the issue is with Flair, there's a lot of struggle and drama. And I understand that, yes, it's very obvious what's going to happen. But there's a lot of, like, might in order to, like, reverse the figure four. The ankle lock submission is, like, brutal because it's so loose and it's just, I don't know, it's just so lame. To me, the issue is the drama shouldn't be whether or not you can survive the hold. The drama should be in whether or not you can apply the hold. So if instead it was really hard for Angle to put on the hold and people were constantly wriggling out of it and just like getting out of it, that would be more interesting than, all right, let's put it on for like, you know, 30 seconds. Okay. Yeah. Do the flip reversal and all that stuff. So, and it's just so loose. And that's kind of my issue with it. I mean, that's a good point about Flair. I mean, he does do it a lot, but that's my major issue is just it's just how long he has it in there and then how lame the reversal ends up looking. And that there's always like five of them. I mean, all right, five is an exaggeration. Like, I think that only happened in like a Shawn Michaels match, but like, there's like, there's always at least two and usually three. Yeah. And it's just like, I don't know. It's just like, dude, why don't you like not put on your finish, have it hard to put on your finish. And then once you put it on, then it's like meaningful, but I see your point. I mean, American wrestling's never really taken submissions that seriously.
No, that's why. I mean, it's not like he's working UWF or something. I mean, and at first I was exactly like you. I mean, exactly the same take. Like, it was not visually very expressive. I mean,
it isn't.
But at some point I figured that it was not the point of it was, yes, you're building the pain. And you're building some reversals to work to something else, basically. Just like Flair. I mean, to me, it's funny because the more I watch Kurt Angle, the more, and some people are going to, I mean, are hating this argument, but to me, Flair was a total go, 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 go worker.
Right, right. This is, I mean,
but this psychology was shit. I mean, he was doing the same spot all over again. It was just doing them at a different point of the match, which made no sense at all. But he had a great flair. See what I did there? He had a great flair for the pace and the flow of the match. And what was the most exciting at what moment in a match? And to me, Kurt Angle works the exact same way. No, he doesn't always make the most sense.
Right.
But you know, I mean, if you think about it, well, why is it so easy to reverse his hold? Okay, so it doesn't make always the most sense, but in terms of flow of the match and pace and how to get the most excitement out of the crowd, is just a master, and exactly like Flair.
All right, so I'm gonna take your Ric Flair comparison. I'm gonna raise you a Harley Race comparison. So hate is a strong word. I do not like watching Harley Race.
Yeah.
And I get a much stronger Harley Race vibe. And I'll tell you what the difference is, what the key difference is between Flair and Angle. I think Flair sometimes gets oversimplified by both sides. I'm pro Flair, so I can sometimes oversimplify his stuff to make it seem like he's always correct. And I think the anti-Flair people sometimes say he has no psychology, which I don't think is true either, which is fine. I mean, Flair is like a 2-hour podcast every time it comes up, right? But Harley Race. So the big difference is Flair has a lot of charisma in the ring. There's a lot of verbal selling. There's a lot of like facial expressions. I find Kurt Angle to be very dry in the ring. And I feel the same way about Harley Race.
Oh, Harley Race is dry. I agree.
Yes. I think Angle is very it was very interesting that you brought up like certain facial expressions you like from Kurt Angle. And I will go back and watch it. I promise I will.
I mean,
because honestly, I've never seen any good acting out of Angle in terms of actual in-ring wrestling.
Does when he's he's leaning on the ropes. I mean, how much more of a douchebag can you be after you saw that huge spot, and instead of going to the pin with urgency, you're like leaning on the ropes and just smiling to the corner like
I'll watch it. I mean, I watch it. I took because I maybe I missed it. It's possible, but
that's such a great spot. It's hilarious, actually. Yeah. But it's just so, what a dick, you know? What a complete dick. And then but one thing about Angle, it's very awkward looking. It, to me, it's one of the great awkward looking pro wrestler, like Akira Taue. They are not elegant the way they move. I mean, look at Kurt Angle. He's great at doing mat work. He's great at throwing suplex. But when he's actually moving, he's super intense. He's super quick and fast and snap without the intensity.
Yep.
But he's really kind of not elegant. You know, elegant. You can say that in English.
Elegant. Like, elegant.
No, it's the same word. Fuck.
Yeah, I think you're. Yeah, no, don't worry. Yeah, elegant. Yeah, I know what you meant. Yeah, yeah, he's not elegant.
It's kind of. It's like, for instance. No, a really elegant worker like Barry Windham or Arn Anderson, Bret Hart, Misawa, and they are the great awkward-looking worker, which it's fun to watch too. Like Akira Taue was super awkward-looking, and to me, it can be like a little bit bizarre because he's obviously a great athlete, but it's not. It's I don't know. It's the way he walk or the way he throw punches. It's kind of always kind of awkward to me. But
yeah, he's not a great puncher. I agree with the walking and the running. He's not a good runner. Yes.
Yeah, odd. It's like and to me, it's kind of it adds a little bit.
I don't know if he did it in this match per se, but he does this a lot. And this is another thing that drives me nuts about Angle is the way he transitions to his part in offense is so like annoying to me. So what he tends to do is he'll just – if you've ever played a wrestling video game like the SmackDown series, like if you hit square enough, you can just break – the collar and elbow tie up, like you just raise your hands up and then he just punches them. And he does this all the time. He just basically says no more and he just punches them.
Yeah, but
like,
you know why?
Drives me nuts.
You know why? You don't find that realistic?
I see what you're saying. It's not
you
like,
know what?
Like
no, but you know why? Because in real life that's what he probably would do. Like someone would try to wrestle with him, he would be okay, enough. Now bam.
Yeah, it's just like, it's not interesting. It's not like an interesting transition. It's just like, all right, it's kind of an abrupt ending. There's like no elegance to his matches either. Like the matches are just like, it's just like, I'm just going to start doing this. And it doesn't really tie back to what I was doing before. I think that's why bugs me.
To me, it's because he's a former amateur pro wrestler and he's such a badass that it works. I agree. It is a group, but it makes sense because he's Kurt Angle and he can.
So I guess, like, so I'm a huge Brock Lesnar fan, right? And I have no issues with Brock Lesnar. And I find Brock Lesnar to be a much like better worker, like beginning to end, like his matches are very smooth and tell a very strong narrative. Usually like Angle's matches have like they're it's just like it's like looking at a Picasso or Picasso. I can actually make more heads and tails of it's like post Picasso, like it's just like paint on a wall.
I don't know. I think Lesnar was probably a great wrestler at some point, but in the later years it's like to me it's unwatchable.
Yeah, like, people agree with you, but I actually think Lesnar's like one of the best workers in the entire world. From start to finish this decade.
Really?
Oh yeah, for sure, 100%.
This decade, you mean this decade?
Like 2010, not 2020, but yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a huge Brock Lesnar.
Well, fan. I've not finished with Kurt Angle, so we're gonna.
Well, we can talk more about Kurt Angle, but yeah,
I assure you, we will.
I know we will. I mean, the match that you have higher is a match that I have too. So I hate Kurt Angle. It's just like I don't know. Oh, the other thing I wanted to bring up because I said no charisma. like they talk about him being a wrestling machine, and it really feels that way sometimes. Like it's just like he's like a machine that manufactures spots, but there's like no zest behind them. There's no passion. It's just like
He's got so much great fire when he's babyface, and he's such a dick heel when he's a heel. That's what struck me when I was watching TNA is that he could do anything. He could do the stupid heel, and it was a great promo too, and it was fed tons of total bullshit angles.
That I will agree with. I actually like Kurt Angle as a character, yes.
And including inside the ring, he was great at the serious kick-ass babyface. He was great at like hate-filled babyface, like in a match with Anderson. But he could be a great dick heel. And it's not, it's the greatest dick heel performance maybe is another match. But anyway, he could do pretty much everything. He could do a brawl. I mean, he could do a garbage brawl. He did that in WWE, less so in TNA. But to me, it became much better in TNA than it was before. Because a few years ago, I mean, you would have asked me the question like 5-6 years ago, maybe. I would have probably said the same thing. I was not a big fan. And I basically became a fan watching TNA.
Okay. I mean, to me, he leaves me cold. I think that's the best way I can explain it. I just do not feel ever emotionally moved watching Kurt Angle wrestle. And that's not to say, like I said, I mean, I did think the Anderson match is great. I had a match on my list that we'll talk about. Yeah. And he was capable of having great matches in WWE. He's definitely had, you know, great matches there too. He has the raw talent, clearly. I mean, he's an Olympic gold medalist. He's very athletic and knows how to wrestle. So I just, like I said, it just kind of leaves me cold. So that's usually my issue. So that was what, your number 9?
Yes.
All right, so my number 8 is similar to a match you've had, but maybe you have higher, maybe you don't have it at all. It's the World Tag Team Champions Triple X, Daniels and Skipper versus America's Most Wanted, but this is the 2003 cage match, not the 2004.
Oh, I hope I didn't get confused. Okay, so no, I don't have it this one.
2004 is the one where he does the really crazy spot off the top of the cage.
Okay. 2004, that's one, okay.
Yep, so you have the 2004. That makes sense. All right, so I'll go through the 2003 one. I implore everyone to watch this because everyone talks about the 2004 one because of the high spot that is like the mother of all high spots. But the 2003 one is also really, really good. And it's just this another like Southern Fried blood feud, just bleeding everywhere. I mean, America's Most Wanted is got to be at least top 50, if not top 25 in terms of tag teams of all time. They are phenomenal. They do the double face in peril inside the cage. Harris bleeds. Storm ends up bleeding. Storm was a great hot tag. But the person that really stuck out to me was Elix Skipper. This dude, it's amazing. I understand that he wasn't a very good promo. But for a dude who was athletic as he was and had like a total death wish, this guy did some insane shit. Not only in the 2004 match, but in this 2003 match, he took a reverse suplex into the cage, which led to an incredibly nasty fall. He then takes a powerbomb off the top of the cage. He does a crossbody off the top of the cage and takes two insane bumps from the cage to the floor. On the last bump, when he hits the floor, he hits it so far and he's so sweaty, he actually skids outside the railing. Like, it's insane what this guy was willing to do. So Skipper went just all the fuck out. I mean, the other three guys were great. It was just this big kick-ass brawl. And what I really loved was because Skipper got knocked out of the cage and it was not an escape rules, you had to win by pinfall. So that meant they didn't win. But it also meant that AMW had a 2-on-1 advantage. And so they're able to take advantage of that. And the finish was a top of the cage death sentence. So if anybody knows, the death sentence is like demolition decapitation, but one is like a leg drop, the other is a knee drop. I can't remember which one's which, but it's basically demolition decapitation. And so from the top of the cage, fucking badass finish, awesome match.
Yeah.
Super bloody, great brawl. Elix Skipper wanted to die. Thankfully, he didn't because he gave us the 2004 match.
Yeah, he tried again.
Yes, he tried again, yes.
Yeah, I can't believe I forgot this. But it was 2003. It was a long time ago. I was very, very depressed when I watched
it. This is the four-sided four-sided steel cage match.
But, I mean, it's crazy when you think about it because, yeah, AMW, totally forgotten tag team. I mean, totally forgotten. Yep. People remember about Beer Money a little more, I think.
Yep.
Because it's more, I mean, it's less dated, and Bobby Roode is in WWE still.
Yep.
But AMW is totally forgotten by now, but yeah, there was such an awesome tag team. And plus, they could play both heels, and because when it turned heel, with Gail Kim as a valet, they were awesome too.
They were great, and they were great with Jarrett. That was the best.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the interesting thing is that given that Jarrett was the cornerstone of the promotion, and I have a soft spot for Jeff Jarrett. I do actually like him. Like, he's not even close to my top 25 in any of his matches. Like, it's amazing that you could be such an important part of the company, not just as the founder, but as like the main event dude for like the first, what, 3 to 5 years, and just not have a match that was close to my top 25.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. His matches were like, I coined them the Double J special, which were like the Dog and Pony Show from Raven, only stupid.
They were stupid.
Yeah. But at some point, to me, it was so stupid that I began to actually enjoy the stupidity. But it was stupid. But it was so stupid that it's like sometimes you really enjoy a really bad movie. And I can't. Okay, so that's the Double J special. You know, it's going to be 100 bullets that don't make any sense. There's going to be tons of guitars. And so, whatever. Okay, go ahead. So it's not surprising that he was never a great worker. He was a really solid, really good worker at his best. But
I see. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. So yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there and just get a little Jeff Jarrett talk in on the TNA podcast. But yeah, it was just unfortunate. But yeah, I guess he just kind of – it was sort of the part of the times and just who he was facing and all that. So what was your number 8?
My number 8, maybe you have it higher, I guess. No, you probably don't have it. I don't know. It's Gail Kim versus Awesome Kong, no DQ from Final Resolution.
Yeah, I probably should have worked this in. The only reason I didn't make my top 25 is because I already had one in there and I wanted to make one for some other things. But this is very similar to the one I had.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, it's pretty much – it's a little bit more violent, actually, because there were no DQ, so they had more freedom to do more insane. And I mean – Gail Kim takes every kind of abuse in this match. There is this spot. They still do that spot today, which is scary as hell. When you see the Awesome Kong takes Gail Kim, she by the legs, you know, outside the ring.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
hurls her into the steel barricade. You see, and whenever they do that spot, the guy which is thrown into the barricade usually protects his neck and head because it's like a commotion city. So like, boom. Like she would do with a golf club, basically. And she really hurled that girl into the barricade. It's so brutal. And Gail Kim is really not afraid to die either. We talk about Alex Skipper in a much more pro. And she's not doing some stupid stuff, but she's really not afraid to die out there. And basically, it's kind of the same match. The only difference is that there is an actual finish on this one. So to me, it was the apex of the feud. Sadly, it didn't last very long after that point. But basically, to me, it's like kind of the same match we talked about before. A little bit more violent. I think it was a little bit more on... I mean, it was still Awesome Kong killing Gail Kim, but Gail had more offense on this one, obviously, because this was the one she would win at the end. No, she won that one.
Yes, she won, yeah.
Yeah, and you told before that you weren't a big fan of the finish. Wait, that.
Yeah, I'm trying to read the finish why I didn't like it. Kong, but there's no ref. Here comes Kong, choke slams Kim. She goes for the power. Oh, it's because it was a roll up off the power bomb. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I think it was kind of a little too fluky. I think is what I didn't care for.
No, yeah. I like it because she's not going to knock out Awesome Kong.
Yeah, I agree, but I think it could have just been decisive, maybe. I don't know. I know what you're talking about, but I guess I just didn't sit. Sometimes those finishes sit well with me, and some other times I feel like they're like kind of just tacked on there. Yeah.
We've been so conditioned with big finishers that we forgot that rolling someone into a small package, it's not a fluke. I mean, the goal is to win a match.
So, no, I agree with you. I'm a big proponent of this.
We have been totally overconditioned to the... And I mean, Japanese wrestling probably has something to do with that, but also, I don't know, the idea of you have to end the match with a finisher and a three count with the other one who is knocked out. And of course you don't. And that's why I used to love Bret Hart, because the Bret Hart match, he was not afraid to do finish like that. And back then, no one, I think, was criticizing those kind of finishes. It was the smartest one. She does not have the physical capacity of Awesome Kong. She's much, much smaller. She doesn't hit as hard. What can she do? So unless you have a killing finisher that you can actually do on Awesome Kong, which she doesn't. Right. So to me, it makes sense. And yeah, it's like the old Bret Hart finish, and I love it.
Yeah, I think I would have to watch it back. I mean, like you said, I'm a total proponent of that. I really do believe that the ultimate goal of wrestling is to put a man's shoulders or woman's shoulders to the mat for 3 seconds. And how you do it, a small package is actually much better than a lateral press, right? You know, you have it stacked up. It's a much more difficult move to actually kick out of. I agree with this 100%. There has to be something about it. What I have written, and honestly, when did I watch this match? I watched it in 2019. Wow. Oh, man, I don't have that much of a memory of it. Kong chokeslams Gale, and she goes for the powerbomb, and then Gale rolls her up. There must be something about the roll-up in the powerbomb. Perhaps it looked too cooperative or something. There might have been some issue there that I didn't care for, but yeah, there was that must have. Otherwise, I can't explain it. The only other thing that I noticed in my review was I think I just kind of liked the – it sounds like I found Gail Kim's offense a little bit more clever in the first match, but I have them rated the same, so it was kind of a pick 'em. I should go back and watch both of them and see, but yeah, they're definitely both great matches, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I had to include it in my top 10 also, because to me, like I said, it was very significant. And because I checked the WrestleMania match that same year, and the women's match was a – Lumberjill, Playboy, whatever.
Yeah, it was a sad. I mean, there was that sort of stretch in the middle 2000s when they had Trish and Lita and Mickie James, and it was kind of taken seriously.
Yeah, Mickie James.
But then it went back into the dark ages there for a while in the late 2000s.
I never understood Lita. Yes, she paid her dues, but to me, she was like a complete shit worker. Everything she did crappy as hell. It was sloppy. It looked Trish Stratus. It's funny because Trish Stratus. A long, long, long time ago, like before she went, she was in WWE. So yeah. she was part of it. That's like the total useless tidbit, but whatever. She was doing a podcast that was called The Law back then.
Oh, yeah.
You saw that? Already I was writing, I was like a stupid, young, smart-ass fan, I guess. And yeah. I was listening to that. Back then we were listening to it on Real Player. So... Yeah.
Yes, I remember Real Player. I am old enough to remember Real Player, yes.
Yeah, oh yeah. And there was one host I really didn't like, and I guess I was writing some really mean letters. And I remember Trish Stratus saying one day, "Oh, we have this listener from France, and he loves us, but he hates you." She was talking about the host. So I was name dropped by Trish Stratus on The Law before she went to WWE.
You know what? That is an insane fun fact.
Yeah. It's insane that I remember, because she wasn't, I mean, was she, I don't think she ever, she was doing anything. She was a host on The Law, but.
I remember this because she did an interview with Steve Austin, and that's where I heard this, yes.
Yeah, and I still remember that. Yeah, because I don't remember the name of the host that I didn't like. And it was annoying to me. I don't know why. But I was an asshole back then.
Well, you know what? Your assholeness got
you. Yeah, we love him. Yes, she hates you, but we love him. So Trish Stratton said that she loved me.
You know what, brother? That's one better than me. So you got that. You could always hang your head on the fact that Trish Stratton said she loved you.
Yeah. 22 years ago. No, but I enjoyed the fact that she could have gone
when she went to WWE, she could like do basically nothing, and she worked super hard to become like decent.
Yeah, so, it was a lot of effort.
It's not like she could work with tons of veterans and have tons of ring work. I mean, she would show up right now at the same age she was back then. She would be much better, I think. Because
oh, I agree with that.
Yeah. Working with her, and she was obviously working super hard. But when you have nothing to work with, it's like you can only progress that much. I mean, I remember the match that was actually really good was the infamous Mickie James match.
Yep.
Because Mickie James was in TNA before, by the way, with CM Punk.
And, yes. Right. Yeah. Yep, I remember.
Yeah.
She was in the – oh, no, she wasn't in that Raven match. She was in a different Raven match I watched.
Yeah, she was in a bunch of Raven matches, yeah. She was funny because she was taking inside bumps too, I remember. She was funny outside the ring and stuff, yeah.
Yes, so that match is – that match – the match with – yeah, the Trish-Mickie match is definitely the best WWE women's match up until like 2014 or something, maybe 2013, okay. Somewhere in that vicinity.
Because Mickie James was really good.
She was another. She's similar to Gail Kim in the sense that they're both about the same age. And thankfully, Mickie's actually getting a run again. She got a really good match against Asuka in NXT, and she had some fun stuff in. I watched a house show match in Boston. I was because it was a house show. I actually got like the closest I've ever gotten to WWE. I sat on the floor like 10th row. Mm-hmm. Normally, I like sit up. Way up high. I don't want to spend a lot of money because who cares? But I was like, oh, it's a house show, so the tickets are not that expensive, so I can actually like see them up close and personal. So I got to see Mickie James versus Ronda Rousey. It's a tag team match, but I can't remember who else was in it. But Rousey and Mickie were just so great. Mickie was playing such a great old school chicken shit heel and was just bumping and feeding for Rousey so well. I'm so glad I got to see Rousey up close and personal. She was great.
Oh, yeah, that must be.
Yeah. Anyways, all right. So that was your eight. Let me go to my seven. My number seven is I think you had this already, so we'll talk about it. AJ Styles versus Bully Ray Slammiversary 2011 Last Man Standing.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah, I have it on it in 23.
Yep, yeah. I think, you had it similar to the other Last Man Standing, which I guess makes sense because they're two similar matches. Yeah, so I like this one a lot. I think what made this one a little bit different is I really felt like they really, really hated each other. Like, AJ versus Daniels was really good and was really bloody. And I think when you're friends, you can really go all out. But at the same time, in the back of your mind, you kind of know they're friends. Whereas this, like, you could see that you could it's possible that Bully Ray and AJ Styles are like best friends or get along really well, but you could also see these two people being so different that they really would not like each other in real life. So it kind of feels like there would be interesting. It at least kind of adds to the environment a little bit, but it's very bloody. The whole match is kind of built on Bully Ray saying there's no real men left in wrestling and that all the men are just like to play video games. Nobody likes to go to strip clubs anymore, that type of bullshit.
Yeah.
And so AJ Styles is, you know, he's calling out AJ's manhood and AJ stands up to the bully. And I think he does a really good job standing up to the bully. You know, it's nothing fancy. It's just kicking ass. It's punches. Best punch this side of Memphis. And he busts out a headbutt at one point. And the way Bully Ray sells the headbutt is so good. Bully Ray was a really, really good heel, both in terms of his mean streak, but also in terms of showing ass and really selling for the babyface. And I think the thing that really stuck out to me, because it's been a while since I watched this match, but the memory I really have is how hard the chops were by Bully. He does the overhand chops similar to like a Ron Garvin. And they're so hard. You can like see the handprint. And not only do you see the handprint, like you can see the bruise start to form. Like it doesn't just like handprint red, like white. It's like starting to turn like blue and purple like instantaneously. It's like insane. AJ is just phenomenal at selling both pain and defiance simultaneously. So like he's letting you know he's in pain, but he's still like, I'm going for more. I'm firing up. And it's just that great combination that makes for great wrestling. So that when AJ finally unleashes, he unleashes with great fury. He looks like a man possessed. He's just beating the shit out of Bully Ray. He's either punching him or hurling his body at him. There's this great spot where Bully Ray gets so desperate that he goes for the chain that he brings out to ringside. And AJ somehow gets a hold of it and then does a Superman chain punch, which was super sick. This gets Bully Ray busted wide open, so you get the blood. And eventually they go outside to do the big spot out at the out in the rampway. AJ Styles kind of goes Jeff Hardy on us and does the really high jump from the scaffolding. I think at the time I really thought they were going to do the super lame finish where they both get counted out to 10, but they don't. And what's interesting is Bully actually kicks AJ in the ass in the last second and sends him through the stage for the win. So I actually kind of liked the finish a lot. I thought it was like a really cool cheap heel finish where it was like it was pretty close, but Bully Ray got that last second lucky fluke thing. So, yeah, great bloody brawl, a lot of big spots. Yeah, really good shit.
Yeah. Again, AJ Styles can do pretty much anything, any kind of match.
And for sure.
Yeah, and he can, and he's great every time. It's kind of scary, actually.
It is kind of, yeah.
Because, he can work heel babyface too, by the way. But in this one, you got to get a lot of credit to Bully Ray because, and actually, what I found out when I was watching the weekly television is that the entire stint of the Team 3D was like, they'd never had a lot of great matches, but they always did exactly what they should have. It's crazy. As far as the veteran stint in a promotion where they are there to put other people over, to be stars and legends, and but yet put other people over and work with other stars from the same generation or with younger people or do comedy or serious hate-filled feud. Everything they did was exactly what they should have done. They put over tons of people. They sold for everyone. And Bully Ray was always the better worker of the two, to me.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Yep.
And to me, that seems like they went way, 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 way up in my anyway, to me. But, but Bully Ray, yeah. To go back to the match, I really love the match, but I didn't love it as much on rewatch for a simple reason. That's basically the same thing as, and not the same thing as the Chris Daniels and AJ Styles, but a little bit still. It's because it's the story of two matches. You have the match inside the ring, and the ending is kind of, okay, so we have done our match inside the ring, which is absolutely great. And now we're going to move to the spot where we're going to do the finish. And it's kind of over-reliance to me on the big spot at the end, which is kind of detached from the entirety of the match to me. It's kind of, okay, we go outside, and now we have to do the spot of the ramp, which is very, very an inheritance of WWF of the late 90s style. Right. But it's not, it's like, it's nitpicking. I mean, it is in my top 25, so I do love the match.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing that you say. You can see like, okay, so now this part is done. We are going to do the big spot at the end, which is insane. And I like you, I love the finish because you really think, okay, the babyface hit that amazing spot, which had nothing to do with Jeff Hardy because Jeff Hardy sucks. And you really believe that, okay, they're going to do the count. And of course, Bully Ray is going to try to get up and fall again at like 9. And then it just pushes. It gives a big push on the ass in the Edge goes through, which is hilarious to see actually, and really really surprising and really creative and really great because it's so cheap and it works wonders. But it's a great finish, and it doesn't take away from the big bump. It's not.
Yeah, cheap. I agree.
The way that it's for instance, I hate one of the matches that basically made me stop being a WWF fan back then in 1999 was the infamous I Quit match, the Rock.
Which
I hated even back then, and I would hate it even more now. It's because all the bullshit that you see during the match, the brutality and stuff, and in the end, it's a total gimmick with the pre-recorded voice, which is I Quit. It takes away basically the entire match. Here, you got the big spot,
And you have, of course, you have a cheap under quotation finish, but it's super clever to me, and it's super well done because again, AJ Styles dives straight, heads straight ahead in the, what do you call that? The it's base, yeah, it's a ramp basically.
Yeah, it's like the stage. Yeah, yeah, I know yes. what you're talking about. Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, but that's just classic AJ, right? Just throwing his body yeah. into the spot.
It looks, it makes it look so good too.
He does. He makes every bump look really good. So
because a crappy worker or a mediocre worker, I'm not sure it would look. It would look kind of awkward, maybe. But since
I think so
AJ
too.
Got the push from the leg, and AJ make it look so great, and it's so funny, it's so cheap to have Bully Ray win the match when really he was done. So yeah, I love the finish too.
Yeah, I agree with that, 100%. Yeah. So what is your number seven? Yep, number seven.
No. Okay, another one, then we're almost done with Kurt Angle.
Okay.
And Jeff Jarrett, yeah. 2009 at Genesis.
Oh, yes, this is interesting. All right, sell this for me. Yep.
And no DQ match. To me, it's like the Jeff Jarrett best match ever. And again, it's Kurt Angle working his magic to me, like working, and really maybe this is actually his best heel performance ever because he's really vicious in that one. Again, he works like badass Kurt Angle, so tons of usual Kurt Angle stuff like ankle lock reversals. Of course, why not? But you have Jeff Jarrett working total babyface. Here it's 2009, so he was coming back. It was like me, he was on and off, I think, with the company at this time. I don't exactly remember the angle leading to the match. Basically, it's the match they should have had in 2011 when they had this great feud with Karen, then Karen Jarrett. They had a great feud as far as angle goes in 2011, and all the match was super disappointing to me. And basically, this is a match they should have had. But I think by that point, Jarrett was beginning to get a little bit older. He was like 45 almost, I believe. So, and Jarrett to me, yes, is never a great worker. Here is a great baby face in front of his own audience. So you talked about it's odd that he never got his moment. To me, this is his moment because yep. he was like the owner of the company was fighting against like the bully. Well, Kurt Angle was really playing the role of a bully here. It's a new DQ match, so tons of blood also. So kind of old school again. And yeah, you got and Kurt Angle is just total dick mode in this match again. But it's a Kurt Angle match, so it's a go match. The work is as good as you're going to get from a Jeff Jarrett match, especially at his age. But to me, what I enjoyed about Jeff Jarrett is that basically he tried to improve his game with age. He wasn't so some people, maybe you're going to tell me that it was actually worse and you enjoyed it more when he was doing more simplistic stuff. But to me, I enjoyed the fact that he tried tons of new things and he tried to add to his repertoire of moves and stuff and tried to adapt to a more quicker pace because it's to me annoying. It's like Terry Funk, you know, who try to adapt with time. I'm not saying right. that Jeff Jarrett is like Terry Funk. But so it's mostly a brawl, even though there are tons of classic angle spots and Jarrett spots. But to me, it's like, yeah, it's end of the decade. It's the best Jarrett match he has. It was 43 maybe. So basically the ending toward the end of his career. And yeah, it's I really love the finish too, which is a callback to the old guitar, which is a stupid gimmick. But at some point, it was really a stupid gimmick. I mean, the whole guitar shot was unbearable for a long time. But at this time, basically, you adopt the stupid gimmick because it's been so long that it becomes canon. And okay, so and plus it's babyface spot. The only thing that was funny to me is that basically the guitar was broken when Kurt tried to use it because you have Kurt was basically seeing the guitar on one hand and a chair on the other with what he's going to choose to hit Jeff Jarrett.
Right.
He's teasing that he's going to use the guitar, which would be almost a babyface spot. And of course, and the crowd, I think, kind of cheers half because still, it's Kurt Angle, so it's kind of cool and people love him even when he's a heel. Again, like Ric Flair. And of course, he drops the guitar, and now I'm going to use a fucking chair to bash Jeff Jarrett's head. So he does. And when it's the turn of Jarrett to use the guitar, the guitar is actually broken. So it's kind of funny to me because he cannot use his stupid gimmick. So he had to use a chair. But yeah, to me, it's a great brawl. And maybe I'm overrating it because I kind of, like you, have a soft spot for Jarrett.
Yep.
Jarrett had this moment of glory in WC. I like his WCW stint in 97 when he was working against Dean Malenko and such. I think it was a fun stint. I hate the Jeff Jarrett from 2000.
I can understand that, yeah.
God, boring. And so maybe I'm overrating it because I really, I wanted to. But I really love Angle's work. And he's kind of Kurt Angle working his magic. And Jeff Jarrett, he gives everything he has left to me in this match.
Yeah. So like I said, this match is pretty famous. You're definitely in the majority. A lot of people really, really like this match. And so it got me really excited because I am a pretty big Jeff Jarrett fan. I've always wanted to see a really great Jeff Jarrett match. Now, that being said, Jarrett versus Shawn Michaels from WWF is awesome and is, to me, still Jarrett's best match that I've ever seen. But always looking for another one. But unfortunately, this one just doesn't land with me. Again, I just feel like it's not the spots. I really do feel like there was something about I just didn't feel the heat again. I just felt like they were just doing moves. Like, especially down the stretch, like, you know, you get the ankle lock, the Olympic slam, pedigree. It just feels like a list of moves that.
I love the pedigree spot. We're going to use the pedigree spot, which has been like death in the biggest company in the world. And we're going to use that basically as almost a transition, like not even a credible near fall. I thought it was so funny.
Well, yes, I mean, that is clearly a pot shot at Triple H. I mean, honestly, Jeff Jarrett and Triple H are very similar. You know, they both took over in the early 2000s. Both are kind of blowhard heels that didn't really get over. They're very similar in a lot of ways, so it's interesting.
Jeff Jarrett was more fun to me. I mean, he was much better baby face when he was straight. But even in Mayfield, well, he was not a great worker, but he had kind of baby face flair in the South. I mean, in Memphis.
Yes, I agree. And like the thing is, like another great Jeff Jarrett match, and like this really shows you how old he is the match he has with Bockwinkel in 1987 in Memphis.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And so like the beginning of this match, I definitely remember I liked a lot because it's Jarrett sticking a lot to his Memphis roots and just punching a lot. Like he has a really good punch. And when it's just all, I felt like once they went outside of the ring, it was fine. It's when they got back in the ring, I kind of felt like this isn't, it just stopped being a brawl. Like I felt like the first half of the match was a brawl and the second half of the match was like, let's just do this Japanese style, hit all our finishers type match.
Japanese, you're pushing it with Jarrett.
Well, you know, I mean, this is.
Yeah, I know.
So, I don't know. I mean, you're definitely in the majority. A lot of people like it. I'll definitely. The thing is, there's so much pro wrestling to watch. So, for the most part, I've only watched a match once, usually. So, hopefully, once I get through a lot of what I've watched, I would like to watch it again and maybe it'll do better with me. But yeah, just wasn't for me this time. Too bad. Yeah. But I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad so many people like it because I'm always happy when somebody like Jarrett, who I like, gets a lot of praise. So that's good. All right. So my number six has been mentioned, so we can talk about it. This is the America's Most Wanted versus Triple X match from Turning Point, the very famous one.
And why is that?
Because it's the high spot to end all high spots. To me, this is the most iconic TNA spot in the history of TNA. And it's the craziest thing.
And obviously, if it wasn't in TNA, it would be one of the most iconic high spots ever. Because it's like, what the fuck? I mean,
it is the craziest thing ever. I mean, so obviously we're talking about.
We watched it the other day and I think, I don't think I've seen anything like that since then or before then. And probably would never see anything because I don't think anyone would be stupid enough to do something like that right now.
I agree with you. I think what's interesting, obviously pro wrestling is dangerous and people have died in the ring and we know that and that's sad. But very rarely do I think while a move is happening, do I think, oh my God, he could actually die. It's possible during any move, of course, that somebody could die. But no, this is like the only move ever I was like, oh my, he's going to die. Like I was like petrified that he was going to fall off that cage while he was doing that tightrope.
Yeah, we're not talking about something stupid like Mick Foley being thrown off a cage.
Yeah.
We're talking about something that takes ability to do.
Yes, and it's like that's crazy. But the thing is, I have it ranked sixth, and it's not ranked sixth because of the high spot. The high spot is crazy.
The match is awesome.
The match is awesome, and it's very similar to the match I just talked about in 2003. It's a bloodbath. There's a ton of great other high spots. Like people forget, Christopher Daniels hit a top of the cage elbow drop. Like in a normal match, a top of the a cage elbow drop that lands isn't a belly flop, but actually lands on an opponent is like insane. So it's just got overshadowed by the fact that Skipper tightrope walked the fucking cage and actually hit the Frankenstein.
Yeah, because it's almost the craziest part. That not only does this insane walk in is walking the cage, but it actually hits the Frankenstein and pretty clean too.
Pretty clean. Cleaner than some people hit like a standing Frankensteiner. Yeah. So,
but why was he thinking? I mean, plus it was a pretty high cage. It was not like those low cages.
No, it was not a low cage. To me, the thing was like, if you're going to fall, you got to fall left towards the ring. You can't fall right because you're fucked if you fall right. So, it was just crazy. Anyways. So,
I wonder if he talked. I mean, of course, he said that to the other guy before. But and then,
That's a great podcast question. If we ever get whoever hit it on, whether it was Chris Harris or James Storm, I hope somebody asked him. So when Skipper said he was going to do it, what did you think? Because I'd be like, are you fucking crazy?
Is it James Storm who took the spot?
To be honest with you, I don't know.
Nobody remembers.
Nobody remembers. Of the two, it seems more likely that Storm would do the front flip off the cage. Like, Harris doesn't seem like the type of guy, but it could be either one.
But nobody remembers who took the spot.
Yeah. It was crazy. Actually, another part of it, the match I really like, is the handcuff part.
Yes.
And what I really liked about it was how Daniels jabbed the key into Storm. Like, this is the thing that could save your partner and save your match. And I'm hurting you with it. I'm making you bleed with it. It's such a great fucking spot. And what I liked about it is it created a mini victory because when they got control of the key, like, it created a crowd pop that was just as big as the finish. Like, it's just as important that he gets the key. So it was like, I liked how that like kind of was like, oh, this is like a hot tag. But like in a steel cage match, you really can't have a hot tag, but it becomes like this huge hot tag. And then there's like a lot of cool double teams, a lot of finisher stealing, which is kind of in vogue at the time. And it's cool because AMW ends up using Triple X's finisher to beat them. And because Triple X loses, they can never team again. So it's kind of cool that they lose to their own finisher in that way. But yeah, tons of blood, tons of crazy double teams. And of course, like the high spot, the mother of all high spots. It's just crazy.
It's crazy because he has been practically forgotten. He hasn't worked after he left TNA. Did he show up anywhere?
I don't think so. It's like shocking to me.
Because he's a guy from the late WCW when they were already fucked, and he was in Team Canada again.
Yep.
From Canada. Was he really Canadian or?
I don't know. I'm looking it up right now.
I'm not even sure. But yeah, this guy just vanished off the face of the earth. He was in TNA during the early days, basically when they were doing the follow up to WCW 2000-2001, basically, which is why I guess he was hired. And so, yeah, it's crazy match. And one thing I really love in that match, that was one of the strong points of AMW, is that their stuff, when they were doing brawling stuff, it really didn't look choreographed at all. It looked super organic. It looked super chaotic. I talked about like being able to read the script. In this match, you absolutely can't read shit. It's like it's total chaos. tons of blood, and it's totally, it flows. I mean, there is, it's not really crisp, but you see, that's why I really prefer this kind of match as opposed to, say, the last man standing, when you have to work from the ring to outside to, you got the ramp and the table, and then you do your big spot, and which you okay, so that's the way it's booked. This kind of match is like complete chaos for like 20 minutes, and there is a structure. I mean, there is some kind of structure, of course. They know what they are doing, but still, you can feel the total chaos, and there is this, yes, two insane spots. The last spot, it's just, I don't explain it still to this day. What was he thinking? I don't know.
So I looked it up. He is not Canadian. He's from New York.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And apparently he doesn't even know that much about Canada, so he thought it was very strange. What is interesting is he's the manager of an Applebee's. Applebee's is a very disgusting restaurant that's a chain in America. But it's in Douglasville, Georgia. If I'm ever in Douglasville, Georgia, I will go to that Applebee's. I won't order any food, but I will try to see if Elix Skipper is there and try to figure out, what the hell was he thinking? Because it's crazy.
Yeah. It should be one of the greatest high spots ever. And everybody.
To me, it's. I don't think you could ever top it. It is. It's just, it's the GOAT high. I mean, it's just the GOAT high spot. It, you know, it's crazy. No.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's your number six?
Okay, so my number six. Sami Callihan, Tessa Blanchard, 2020, Hard to Kill. So the rematch.
Yes.
And the first match was really Tessa Blanchard trying to resist this bad heel. And now she knows that she can fight with him almost on an equal footing. And she's going for the world title this time. So the dynamic is a little bit different, although, of course, it's still Sami Callihan beating on Tessa Blanchard. But this time, She had some great selling periods. He's torturing her, but it's more equal and it's just as intense. And again, it's pretty much, it's not very different. I would compare it like we told about the two Awesome Kong and Gail Kim match, basically, because it's intergender, but it's kind of the same dynamic, because you have it's not a monster heel, but still there is the clear underdog quality to Tessa Blanchard for obvious reasons, and she's going to fight from underneath, and she's going to bring it. And to me, what puts this match over the edge to me is, like, again, tons of heat and tons of, I mean, sometimes there is this thin line in pro wrestling when you feel like it's kind of real to the participant and to the audience. And so it adds something with some kind of emotion and intensity to it. And this was the case in this one, again, for very obvious reasons. And yeah, so not that much different from the first match. There were a ton of callbacks to the first match to this one in terms of spots. And because what worked for Callihan, obviously, is not going to work this time around. Same kind of structure still, like tons of submission work by Callihan with Tessa Blanchard selling and crying and trying to go to the ropes and beating her fingers to not say I quit or stuff like that and not tap out. And again, Tessa Blanchard, awesome worker. Sami Callihan, awesome heel. Super stiff work, super stiff, or at least it looked stiff. But like I said, I think it was pretty safe. But the intensity and emotion to me really bring that to the other level. Because the heat was insane, and the audience was totally for Tessa to win that world title, which will be a first, and I don't know if there were going to be a second time ever. I'm not sure, but we'll see. So I have nothing much to add compared to the first match in terms of pure in-ring work, because it's pretty similar and just as great, but to me it's a matter of the emotion of the whole thing, which, yeah, to me it's like two classic matches, and so unique too, because, and yeah, basically to me it's my favorite match for Impact in 2020. It's still one of my favorite matches of the year, because the pure emotion, mm-hmm. there was a mother and a sister in the crowd, and it's funny because, of course, it's pro wrestling, so we know what it is, but still there is this feeling of reality to it, and because it, in a way it was real, You know, you, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, when you like, I mean, I think that's whenever I try to talk to wrestling fan, non-wrestling fans, you know, I tell people, friends, or you know, so you start dating someone and you have to explain that you're a wrestling fan. It's always like, it's always a little bit of an ordeal. You sort of take a deep breath and go, well, here it goes. Here's my explanation of professional wrestling. I feel like I've gotten better and better every time I've had to do it. So like over the past like 10 years,
we're getting better at it.
Okay. Yeah, but to me, like one of the things that people come up with is like the titles. Like what's up with the titles? They're not real, right? But the titles are very real to the people, and if you really believe in the fans really believe, they're very real to us too, because it's an award. It's a lifetime. It's not like it's a career achievement award up until that point in your career. It's the office and the company saying, we believe that you do good business. We believe that you will get fans to come in to watch you. You'll drive ratings. You'll drive merchandise sales. And so it's the pinnacle. It's like getting a – I always tell people it's like either winning an Oscar or getting a promotion. The company still decides whether you got a promotion, but the promotion is based usually on your hard work and your success. And so I think it's very similar. And so for Tessa, yeah, of course it was very real. And I think – yeah, I think that's the big thing that kind of – and I actually – this is – I wanted to talk about this at some point. Well, not really. I thought about this, but I didn't know that I was going to talk about it, but I'll talk about it here. Is to me, like I listen to a lot of Steve Austin's podcast. I really like what he talks about, and I enjoy him generally. But one of the things that they often complain about, like when he's talking with another wrestler, is like, oh, kayfabe's dead. And the reason they say kayfabe is dead is because fans stopped believing, and they say it's, you know, because of Vince and all that, which I think is bullshit. I think the reason kayfabe is dead is because the wrestlers stopped believing in kayfabe. So a lot of the wrestlers will sort of sleepwalk through matches or go through the motions, or it will look like a rehearsal. It won't doesn't look real. Or, not that wrestling ever looked real, but it doesn't look like they're trying as hard as they could. They're not as invested. But when you get moments like Tessa winning that title, and first off, Tessa's always invested in everything she does.
Yeah,
she's always hitting on all cylinders. She's always running full force. She's always very intense and just wound up really tight. And so, and same with Callahan. He is committed to the character. There are two people who believe in kayfabe. Callahan truly believes in being a disgusting heel that is cowardly, like we talked about, where he cries and he's willing to sell too. And Tessa's the same way.
Also, that's why basically they were my two MVPs for Impact the previous 2 years. I mean, in their respective division, and then when they got together, because everybody they were working with were elevating, especially Callahan, because Tessa had the chance to work with like Taya and stuff. So it was. Yes, Taya was already like a superstar, but Callahan, to me, you talked about this match. I don't, you won't have it in your list, but the infamous match with Rich One, the entire feud, to me, it totally made Rich One, for instance.
Yeah, no, there was one in Rebellion where Rich One basically had to out Callahan, like go even more extreme, more hardcore. Yeah. That was great. And then they had a No Surrender match, which is it was on free TV. It was just a special. But what was interesting was it was in Ohio, right? And OVE stands for Ohio versus Everyone. And so it was this interesting crowd dynamic where half the crowd recognized that whether Callahan's from Ohio or not, he's a fucking asshole. We're booing him. But half the crowd's like, he's from Ohio. We're cheering him because he's the hometown boy. And so you get that cool split, which is a real split. It's not like that the fake-ass split where people do the dueling chants just to do the dueling chants. Like, it was a real split where half the crowd was like, I don't care where he's from, he's an asshole. And half the crowd's like, he's our boy. We got to look out for him. And it was cool, and they wrestled a really – it felt like an 80s house show championship match. It was really good, and Callahan's a good heel. But, yeah, that's just my point is it's totally up to the wrestlers. They're still in control. They can make us believe – kayfabe can still live – if the wrestlers believe, and Callahan and Tessa are two wrestlers that still believe in kayfabe, and it's not surprising to me that they have great matches that invoke real emotion because they truly believe in their characters and what they're doing. So I think it's a lesson for, you know, is that, you know, we can, you, wrestling can still be pro wrestling. You just got
to
believe.
I have to give credit because, of course, there's a wrestler, but one thing important is the booking, too.
That's true, too. The booking
and
is
Scott Damore and Don Callis, to me, are doing the most, like, efficient booking with what the resource they have. I mean, this feud basically was super simple. First match was I can fight men. So, and Callihan was like the biggest heel in the company.
Yep.
Tessa, the best woman superstar, wants to fight men. They have the first match. She comes super close to beating Callihan, but not quite. Then Callihan wins the world title, and then Tessa win the rights to fight for the world title, and then at the end they meet, and then at the end the crowd is going insane, and they are dying for Tessa to win, and at the end Tessa wins. Oh my God, it's so complicated booking.
Right, and I think one thing is that's really interesting to me, and I'm going to try to say this as nuanced as possible, is it's in a lot of ways we've been desensitized to men versus men. We've just seen it for so long, especially people like me and you who've watched like so much wrestling, that I've gravitated towards the women. I just find their characters to be more interesting, and not even necessarily that their matches are better than the men. So usually they're about the same. Sometimes they're worse, what have you. And I'm talking about in WWE in general. Like, yeah. I just find Sasha Banks and Asuka and Bayley just more interesting to watch. I think because they're women and the characters, like, no matter you know, female or male, like there's always going to be a, like a twist to the character because it is a woman. And it's an interesting twist because we're just, I've been watching men wrestle for so long. It's nice to see something fresh. Like, yes, nobody can do the boss, like no man can do the boss like Sasha Banks.
Yeah.
Is Sasha Banks kind of doing a take on Ric Flair? Like, everyone's kind of doing that because Ric Flair's kind of doing a take on Buddy Rogers and Gorgeous George. Like, everybody's kind of doing that. But because Sasha's a girl, it's different. It's a nice twist, and I like it. And I think that's the same thing with Callahan versus Tessa Blanchard. If Tessa Blanchard instead was Rey Mysterio, it wouldn't have the same impact, even though Tessa Blanchard is bigger than Rey Mysterio.
Yeah, it would be a great match too, but it was the classic big heel, dirty heel, undersized babyface, and it probably would have a great match, but it's, So, of course, the intergender, I mean, it's obvious the intergender aspect of it adds a lot to the emotion and the uniqueness of the match, and the fact that, I mean, the ending of the match, she's absolutely crying and she's not acting.
I believe that's really, very, it's a big deal.
Yeah, and that's a rare moment. I mean, it happens a lot in Japan, like in the like during the retirement, or even I mean, because there's something more real, I guess, in the approach. But to me, the emotion, like I said, the match is great. Pretty much the same kind of match they had before. A little bit better because they went a step further. So I had to work a different finish. But and a different finish that would actually be believable. And that's where Callihan actually is like a great worker, because until you are totally against intergender wrestling, so which I can understand, but if it's okay for you, still it has to work in a way that you believe it. And what's interesting is that unlike the Amazing Kong Gail Kim when she basically did a roll-up, this match, you had to have Tessa basically win the match clean and beat Callihan in the sense where he's beaten, he's knocked out, and she's a badass, and she won. And it worked. I mean, it's credible, it's believable, and that's a lot of Callihan because the way he sells and bumps for her, but that's a lot on her too because her offense is so intense and so crisp, and so, she brings it like no one else in the... maybe Ivelisse brings... she brings it too much, maybe, for some people. love Ivelisse.
There might be a connection between intensity in the ring and attitude outside the ring.
Not everyone can be... Anyway, so I love this match, and for people who say that it lacks emotion and realness and really people going straight rooting for the baby face to win and not just see another match with big moves, again, it happened in January this year. And what I believe the next, because it doesn't happen that often, like when it becomes real. Yep. I predict the next time it's going to become real like that, it's when Eddie Kingston win the world title.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, that's an interesting point. I do follow AEW. I definitely love Eddie Kingston. Yeah, it's definitely possible. Yeah.
Switch the title to him at one, which they should do, and he's going to be the biggest babyface ever. And the day they do that, it can be like a great moment of truth in pro wrestling.
He's another one who he keeps kayfabe alive. You know, in his promos, there's nothing but conviction. That dude believes every single word he's saying for a shoot. And I love it. That promo, the most recent one, where he turned his back to Moxley and Moxley had to cut his promo to the back of Kingston.
Yeah.
And you can see Kingston's face the whole time. Yeah. Fucking perfect. You know,
he's living it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. And I understand that wrestlers aren't trained actors and asking them to be as good as actual actors is a little too much, but I think it's not too much to ask them to believe. And I think people like Eddie Kingston, Sami Callihan, and Tessa Blanchard are really good at doing that.
And actually, they don't need to be. That's the difference to me between the god awful drama of NXT. You know, the match with Sorry, I Love You. So.
Yep.
Difference between this and between Eddie Kingston or Tessa, because we don't ask them to be good actors. We ask them to live the fact that they are pro wrestlers.
I agree with you. Yep, that's true.
And if they live as pro wrestlers, it works because they don't need. Of course, sometimes they do some acting bit and comedy and whatever. But for the moment of truth in pro wrestling, you have to live like Tanahashi in Japan, for instance. The guy lives pro wrestling. They just need that. They don't need to do bad soap opera drama, which is just like the worst thing ever. Because, like you said, they're not trained actors, and we don't want them to be trained actors. We want them to be pro wrestlers who lived as pro wrestlers.
I agree with you. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think that's really the key at the end of the day. Is it's the thing that I think I want the most in wrestling now is just the wrestlers to believe again. And I think everyone will be better for it. So, so I guess I can move on to number 5.
Yes, I think, yeah.
Okay. So actually, I was just doing that.
There was one match no one has talked about yet. And I think we both have it in our list. I believe.
Yes.
Maybe I'm wrong.
So actually, I just said that only to make it easier for me to edit it. So I'm actually running a little late. I'm supposed to meet up with the wedding party for a dinner.
Okay.
So unfortunately, we have to end here. But we did make good progress. We got a lot of footage. So this was a really good conversation. Yeah. I'm going to hit stop and fingers crossed. And that's a wrap for Pro Wrestling Love Volume 4, covering numbers 10 through 6 on the greatest TNA Impact Wrestling matches of all time. Jerome and I hope that you enjoyed listening to this episode and are looking forward to the finale, the grand finale, numbers 5 through number 1, the best of the best for TNA Wrestling, aka Impact Wrestling. Hope everyone enjoyed the podcast. And for Jerome, we look forward to seeing you next week.